This is Tony Roberts, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth since 1960.
You've got to start off each day with a song. Now, even when things go wrong, you feel better, you even look better. I'm here to tell you that you'll be a go-getter. Now the way that you shake my hand will tell me how I stand. Now isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong. If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day with a song.
Oh, sing it, Jimmy boy.
Even when things go wrong,
sing it for the hoi polloi.
You feel better, you even look better. Ah, that music, it does something to me. I wish I knew what it was. Last night I was telling Umbriago about my latest concerto called Tony's Pushcart. He said, Tony's Pushcart, how does it go? I said, it doesn't go, you have to push it. I got a million of them. Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
You start off each day with a song. You've got to start off each day. Boys, please, soft. Little more fortissimo. I want to relate a yarn. Turn back the pages of history and what do you see? Madison Square Garden or Odeo. And there I was, interviewing a prize-winning cow. I asked her to tell the radio public how she feels. She said, moo. She's contented. I'm contented, but her husband ain't. So what happens? The bull ups to me. I ups to him, and without any preliminaries, I'm flat on my back. Being a gentleman, I apologized. But the bull's not satisfied. He demands an autopsy. So I grabs him by the tail, and what happens? He flips his tail. I lands on his head. He flips his head. I lands on his tail. He's playing ping pong with me, and I'm losing. Just then, the bull is ready to charge again. I gets an idea. I start singing, south to the border, down Mexico way. And what happens? The bull starts crying. But irregardless, I keeps on singing. This time with the castanets. That's too much for the bull. He collapses. A cheer goes up. I'm saved. And the moral is, you gotta start off each day with a song. You've gotta start off each day with a song.
Oh boy, you're singing now.
Even when things go wrong.
Oh Jimmy, you're a wow.
You feel better. You know, I'm walking down Broadway and who taps me on the shoulder? My pal hit him in the head, Schwartz. I said, who are you working for now? And he said, the same bunch, the wife and the kids. Now, isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
You start off each day with a song.
That's Jimmy. I'm David, and I'm back. It's Saturday, February 3rd. And I say that with happiness because January's gone. I think we could just eliminate January. I'd be much happier. You might too. Go from New Year's Day right to February 1st. The only thing in January worth paying attention to is Dr. King's birthday. And we could do that on February 1st as it usher in Black History Month with a celebration of Dr. King, because January, the days are unlit. It's cold and nothing's happening. So my recommendation is we go from, well, just eliminate January. It would be, although those of you that have a birthday in January may argue with it. Other than that, I don't hear a good argument. I was not here last week. Many of you told me that Gary Noh filled in and told you how you could live longer, the theme of his program. And I hope you paid attention because living longer, it's a good and a bad possibility. Good if you're in good health and you want to stick around. If Donald Trump is elected, you may not want to, you know, toss in all your marbles to live longer and see what's going to happen. Going out peacefully and quietly might be preferable to a Trump regime. So, what's happening while I was away? I can't even begin to deal or assess what's happening in the Middle East. It's way out of my what's the phrase that, well, I just want them all to stop, just stop. And I don't have any insight how it can be. I think Netanyahu should go, that they should sit down and talk. But I leave that to people wiser and more, well, I don't know if anybody's around that has, who would we need in that? I think we would need Dr. King and Golda Meir and maybe Sadat and some people to sit down and figure it all out. All those folks dying in the Middle East. Anyway, you all have more opinions. Well, I have opinions on it, but I don't feel qualified to get into it. I did see in this morning's paper that Alan Weisberg is getting ready to talk to Alvin Bragg. He, the chief financial advisor for you-know-who, Mr. Trump. Weisberg had a little taste of Rikers, so he might not be entertaining the thought of going back for perjury in behalf of a man who he has to know is a total Philistine. He worked with him long enough. He got enough money out of him, so did his kids. But I think Alan's Weisberg is not ready to take another fall for the big guy. The other thing that happened while I was away, the Knicks, it's Jalen Brunson's team. You know, Julius Randle is out with an injury, those of you who are au courant about the Knicks. And I think they're a better team without him. That Villanova group led by Brunson. I watched the last of the Indiana game the other night, the last quarter, and it reminded me of those golden days of Clyde and Reed. And then when, you know, when there was nothing more exciting in New York, the Madison Square Garden in the fourth quarter with the Knicks taking a fast break and the electricity in the crowd. And the other night, after the game was over, Kenny Smith on TNT had this insight. They were interviewing Brunson, and they now the interviews not only go to us watching on television, but it's broadcast. Kenny Smith said something remarkable happened. 19,500 people after the game was over stayed in their seats. And he said, this isn't some little honky-tonky town. This is New York where there's a lot of places to go when the game's over. And they stayed there and they celebrated. And when the Knicks are clicking, there's a magic and an electricity in New York. And for you non-basketball fans, tune in. They're playing the Lakers tonight with LeBron James. I don't know if they're on a 9-game winning streak. They're going to have to drop one. But there's an excitement and a camaraderie about it. And it is Brunson's team. He's the new hero. He could be elected mayor tomorrow. That's my thought. I'm David Rothenberg. The name of the program is Any Saturday. We get tickets because we are a desperate radio station to get your pesos so that, or your euros, as it were, so that we can survive. We're listener sponsored. And I get theater tickets. Well, there's a show starting preview, not for a couple of weeks, but I heard about it maybe 3 or 4 months ago, and I started making calls saying, this is for the BAI listeners. We have to have tickets for it. Well, we got them. And it doesn't. The first preview isn't until Thursday, February 15th. And I want to put this out forward first. I know many, many, many of you say you have to go on a matinee. I'm with you. You know, I'm a golden oldie, and going during the daytime is important. But when you only have two pair of tickets for a matinee, and 30 people want it, sort of eliminates it. So I hope you are more flexible with this show when I tell you what it's about. First, let me tell you, one of the big musical hits in New York in the last couple of seasons is called The Six. It's a musical about six women who were involved with Henry VIII, most of them named Anne and some of them beheaded. And it's a big hit. Well, The Five is about five women who are affiliated with a person who's very similar to Henry VIII. I'm not going to tell you his name, but the women's names are Ivana, Ivanka, Melania, Marla, and Stormy. And it's a musical review. And I talked to a producer who went to a Backers audition. And he said, it's hysterical and slightly lewd. And I love the combination. It's coming to one of my favorite little theaters off Broadway, the 555 West 42nd Street. We have tickets. If you make a $60 gift to BAI, you will get two tickets. You don't get them in the mail, by the way. You pick them up at the box office. I keep getting emails. I haven't gotten tickets yet. Do you trust the United States mail that you think we would even bother to send them in the mail? No. So the first, I'll tell you about the first week. Thursday at 7, this is the 15th. Thursday the 15th at 7, Friday the 18th at 8, Saturday the 17th, 5 and 9. 5 o'clock is, you're out by 7, so it's still light, Altacacas. And Sunday at 3 and Monday at 7. And we're offering them now for the first 2 weeks. The 5. I can't wait to see it. If you want to be among the cognoscenti going to see it, you email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com and give your phone number. And then I'll call you today because I have dedicated my Shabbases to talking on the phone all day long to BAI listeners. Somebody said, how are you spending your weekend? And my answer is on the phone. I want to give one other warning. Not a warning. It's a plea. If you want to change the date or you can't go, email me, as most of you do. Don't call the box office. The box office doesn't know what you're talking about. Here's what happens in the American theater. The theaters are owned by theater owners. They rent the shows out. They rent the space out to shows. I deal with the show. When I went to try and get tickets for you, for listeners, I talked to the press agent or the general manager or the producer, whoever I might know or have some insight with, or the marketing people, less marketing than I want. And they make the ticket. I send them the names, your name, and they send it to the box office. The box office don't know from me, from Adam. And sometimes we're in danger of losing future tickets for a show because people have created problems. You know, somebody says, I can't go Tuesday night. I want to go Sunday matinee. Well, they didn't offer us Sunday matinee for the simple reason. Well, for whatever reason they have, usually they're sold out. So don't call the box office. Email me. So the 5, dprfortune@hotmail.com. I haven't gotten any yet. I wonder why. I usually there's a. There they are. Oh, they're coming in. Oh, about 8. Let's hear some music. We're starting off. I don't know if you like this guy. I do. His name is Nat King Cole. This song was written by Jimmy Van Heusen and Johnny Burke, and I love Nat Cole. Here he is.
No need to tell me now what makes the world go round. When at the sight of you, my heart begins to pound and pound. So won't you tell me when we will meet again? Sunday, Monday, or always. If you're satisfied, I'll be at your side. Sunday, Monday, or always. No need to tell me now what makes the world around. when at the sight of you, my heart begins to pound and pound. And what am I to do? Can I be with you? Sunday, Monday are always Sunday, Monday are
Well, I was mistaken. I just pressed a little thing, and the number of people who have sent in so far for the five is I would call it an avalanche. A couple of you didn't give your phone number. If you know who you are, send it. Otherwise, I'm going to be forced to send you a scolding email asking for your phone number. I need your phone number so I can call you back. And with a show like the five kicking off February, maybe it's a good time for me to tell you because at least a half dozen of the names that have rushed in to see the five are going to be easy to call because they are already among the $200 givers. What we do on Saturday morning is ask if you want to give $200 or more. And then if you go to more than one or two shows in a 3 or 4 month period, then you've prepaid. And so it's much simpler. I just call you up and say, what day and goodbye. And it's all set. So if you want to make a gift to BA of $200 or more, a couple of people have given $300, a couple have given $500. And it's not just a donation. You prepaid for a lot of shows that you might otherwise not have seen and wouldn't be able to afford. You know, $500 could get you a single ticket for Hamilton. Here you might see a half a dozen shows, you and your partner. Would see a show. So my suggestion is if you're considering going to the theater a lot and you hear what we have to offer, and the season is getting underway, you know, January, nothing happens. That's why I want to get rid of January. Well, I've been hinting at sports, and the big sports story, of course, is Taylor Swift. Will it transcend sports? I watched Jean Pirro for a moment. I thought, if she had a way, I think she would swallow Taylor Swift, who has committed the great crime of having a boyfriend on the Kansas City Royals. And for some reason, the cameras flash to her whenever he does something outstanding. It's not particularly innovative in television sports coverage. I don't think I've ever seen a Knick game where at some point they don't introduce, well, always Spike Lee. He's a standard. This season, it's been mostly Tracy Morgan, John Leguizamo, sometimes Whoopi. Depends on who's hot these days, and there's always a giant football player or Aaron Judge has shown up. I don't know what celebrities are showing up at the Memphis Grizzly games, but I do know that there was a time when a Laker game you would see Jack Nicholson and Deion Cannon among many, many luminaries from Hollywood. So it's not so surprising that the most celebrated singing star of our day, Taylor Swift, who's having a partnership with, what's his name, Kelsey, who's a terrific pass receiver. And I don't know why. Well, here's the why. She has used her celebrity to be a responsible citizen. She has 297 million followers around the world. Is it million or thousand? I don't know these things. I think it's million around the world. But she has about 75 million Americans, and they're mostly young people. And she has used her celebrity to get people to register to vote. Well, the far right doesn't want a lot of people to vote because democracy is not their milieu. Fascists and people like Jean Perrault know that the Republican Party survives when fewer people vote. That's why they go to so much trouble to keep people from voting, making it difficult, making voting spots inaccessible. And so the Taylor Swift's, well, they're also terrified that she's going to endorse Biden among many people who will endorse him, but she has sway. The filming of her concert tour was one of the big movie makers of the year. And she is I couldn't tell you a Taylor Swift song if I heard one, but she's a very amicable personality, a kid who made it big, and she's being a responsible citizen. And boy, does Fox hate her. And Trump made the statement, I'm more popular than Taylor Swift. Well, Donald, the jury's still out on that one. Since the Super Bowl is next week and Taylor's beau will be in it, I've written Super Bowl limerick that I created while away. It goes like this, if you know limericks. Kansas City has a quarterback with style. He goes by the name of Mahonis, and he can toss the pigskin a mile, but he's best known for his cojones. Let's hear from Rosemary Clooney.
It's so peaceful in the country. It's so simple and quiet. You really ought to try it. You walk about and talk about the pleasant things in life. It's so restful in the country. It's the right kind of diet. You really ought to try it. You read a book or try to cook like any good man's wife. City living is a pretty living. It's so full of unexpected thrills. But there's too much stone, too much telephone. There's too much of everything but trees and hills. It's so peaceful in the country. It's so simple and quiet. Someday you're bound to try it. The only place to be, the place for you and me, where it's peaceful in the country. It's so full of unexpected thrills. But there's too much stone, too much telephone. There's too much of everything but trees and hills. It's so peaceful in the country. It's so simple and quiet. Someday you're bound to try it. The only place to be, the place for you and me, where it's peaceful in the country. It's so peaceful in the country with you.
Rosemary Clooney sang that song, and it was written by one of the most underappreciated songwriters of our time, well, not of our time, of the last, in the last century, and that was Alex Wilder, of whose, there's a certain mood about a Wilder song that I've always appreciated. So many people have emailed me so far for the five that I'm sure we're going to have to go into the second week for those of you who didn't email on the first 10 seconds. You know, I don't know what time. I'll tell you the first one came in was 8:10. That must be when I first mentioned it. And by 8:17, there must have been about 25 people that have responded to tickets to see the five, which starts on, I've had so many questions. It's preview start Thursday, February 15th. We have Thursday, Friday, two on Saturday, one on Sunday, and then Monday the 19th, and then the whole following week, Thursday, Friday, two on Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. So COVID's back. I keep talking about that. There was a story, or several stories, that people are resistant to getting the new vaccination. They're not anti-vax. They just feel they've been over-vaxxed. Well, just because you've had a lot of vaccination doesn't mean that it's not here. And I would recommend that you get it, because people are getting it. And it's, people are dying, especially if you're a senior. And who listens to the radio but seniors? I would recommend it. One of the interesting things about the anti-vax population, of which there are many, particularly followers of you-know-who, syphilis is up 80% in the last year. I guess since, well, that was a year ago. I guess post-pandemic, people are going out more and finding partners, sexual partners, with whom they are not, whose hygiene they are not familiar. So, and the interesting thing, the state with the highest percentage is South Dakota, the highest increase. And I bring that up because I wonder if people who are resistant to the vaccinations are getting penicillin when they're, or whatever is treating syphilis these days. In my day, it was penicillin. I wonder if they're getting the shots to cure the syphilis, all those anti-vax people, because I suspect a couple of them are now carriers of the syphilis virus. It's merely a health question, which I'm asking. We do have tickets for other shows besides the five. Make Me Gorgeous has continued to run. It's probably one of the, in terms of BAI, one of the most successful fundraising shows we've had, partially because it's had a long run and continues to, you know, it was supposed to close December 31st. And because so many of you have wanted to see it a second and third time to bring friends and relatives. Darius Rose has taken over the lead role of Kenneth Marlowe. It's an extraordinary story. Where's my review of it? I said of this that Make Me Gorgeous, a vivid portrait of Kenneth Marlowe, a colorful performer, hairdresser, whorehouse madam of another era, is much more than a voluptuous entertainment. It's indeed that funny, poignant, and audacious, but in today's clouded political climate, it contains layers of social commentary just by its very existence. I'm not going to go into all of that. By the way, oh, I just want to tell you, it is, you go into the theater and it's, you've gone into Kenneth Marlowe's reception room. That's what it feels like, his salon, and your guests, and he tells you his story. It's a great entertainment. People have, well, myself included, have just loved Make Me Gorgeous. It continues with Darius Rose, who in the lead. We have tickets this week and next week, Monday at 7, Thursday at 7, Friday and Saturday at 8, next Sunday at 2 and 7, and then same schedule for the whole following week. It's $50 for a pair of tickets to see Make Me Gorgeous. And if you haven't, I couldn't recommend it more highly. By the way, the five is not the five. I've just been alerted. It's five. There's no the. It's that simple. You're not going to see all of you folks. You're not going to see the five. You're going to see five. And the five are, as I mentioned to you, Ivana, Ivanka, Melania. Who'd I leave out? Marla and Stormy. All right, we're going to play. Let's have some music. We'll hear from Vic Damone with a Jimmy Webb song, and then I'll do Out on a Limb. Okay?
By the time I get to Phoenix, she'll be rising. She'll find the note I left hanging on her door. And she laughed when she reads the part that says I'm leaving. 'Cause I've left that gal so many times before. By the time I make Albuquerque, she'll be working. She'll probably stop at lunch and give me a call. She'll just hear that phone keep on a ringing. Off the wall, that's all. By the time I make Oklahoma, she'll be sleeping. She'll turn softly and call my name out loud. And she'll cry just to think I'd really leave her. Though time and time I've tried to tell her so, she just didn't know I would really go. She'll turn softly and call my name out. I'd really leave her. Though time and time I've tried to tell her so, she just didn't know I would really go.
Vic Damone, as has been pointed out so cleverly by listener Tom, probably not called The Five and is called Five. because there's an odious little program that I watch occasionally at 5 o'clock on Fox with Gene Pirro. And there were other people on it, Greg Gutfeld, Jesse Walters, all very attractive people. She's the one that I think I can't watch Gene Pirro too long, because remember the movie with it was a Woody Allen movie, and Jeff Daniels came off the screen. He was an actor in a movie, and he saw in the audience Mia Farrow, and he was so attracted that he left the screen and came out. Well, I think Gene Pirro's going to, when I'm watching television, I think she's going to come out and attack me. I think she's just going to leave for. What's the name of the wonderful woman in Saturday Night Live? Is it Cicely Strange? What's her name? She's in an off-Broadway show coming up, too. And I'm probably messing up her name. She does the brilliant parody of Gene Pirro. All right, Out on a Limb time. It's an essay I do weekly. It's daunting to be an American in 2024, trying to imagine what the country would become if Trump retakes the presidency. I'm not talking about the political intrigue and edicts that are always evident in government. How will our day-to-day lives be affected or altered? We've seen those movies and we've read the books of people who lived under a fascist regime, and Trump has proclaimed he would become a dictator on day one. We know of Anne Frank and her family huddled in an attic, fearful of what was inevitable. We know that in our own nation, men and women and their children were once owned by other individuals. Families split up when bought and sold on slave blocks, their every living moment determined by a Amasa. That's part of our history. And in some states, that truth is being blocked out, making me wonder if the past is to be part of our future. Trump has alluded to eliminating his enemies, who by his definition are his political opponents or critics. Moi. His pal Putin has put political foes in the Siberian gulag. I've lived a long time in America, taking for granted that there were always challenges to our democracy, and I watched and participated in movements for social change that celebrated diversity and opportunities for those once marginalized. Dr. Martin Luther King marched and millions followed. He provided something greater than political change. His dreams contained hope. Barriers fell and dreams were pursued. There were setbacks, resistance. It's what's called, and what we call, the struggle. And within that struggle were grains of hope. I recall the night we waited and then cheered for the election of Barack Obama. And I was not alone in recognizing that the long path to Obama's presidency began on the streets of Selma, Chicago, New York, and points north, east, south, and west, where people marched. We sang and we laughed because we knew we were helping to make good things happen for people who in years past had their dreams smothered. I began working with men and women who had been in prison, persons who had committed crimes, were convicted, sentenced, and imprisoned, and I learned to a person that their downward spiral began long before they ended up in a courtroom. I learned that the people I was to meet at the Fortune Society had survived a prison system that ruthlessly continued society's shortcomings, a system that nurtured alienation and denying its inhabitants of any understanding of why they landed there. I became part of a movement that gave voice to some of the most marginal people in my country, people for whom poverty, racism, physical and mental abuse, and hunger determined their traveled path before they became aware of cause and effect. All the pieces fit, dysfunctional or non-existing families, drugs and alcohol, poor or no schooling, and hunger. And I always cite my friend Casimiro Torres, who said, at the age of 10, I discovered weed and wine, and from then on, that's how I managed my pain. And then he had 16 years in prison, followed by a childhood, abandoned to youth houses and juvenile facilities before he came to the Fortune Society and reclaimed his life. And I cite tell Taz a story, not because his experience was unique, but because he has grown to articulate the similar lives of thousands of men in jails and prisons and in the drug culture. The excitement for us was to learn that in America, we could challenge and remove the barriers, that lives could be reclaimed. And within the struggle that the Kaz Tories and hundreds, thousands like him made the struggle justified and to continue. So looking back on my life, it's been the people, the determination that affected change and created hope. That has been the majesty of America, a flawed nation that has begun to acknowledge its historic failings and told the world we're ready to make amends, never to forget the evils of the past, but not to have the past affect us so we can't move forward, to light one candle rather than to curse the darkness. It's called hope, and it's a precious commodity. So what about tomorrow? About the possibilities, not the inevitabilities, but the possibilities of what Trump has proclaimed. He didn't invent evil. He's merely brought it to the center of power. The evangelicals have accepted the notion that he has been placed here by God, which makes me believe that some influential evangelical leaders have had political have received political payoffs one way or the other, so that their flock can overlook a man whose obscene video and sexual allegations and financial duplicity and leader of an insurrection to overthrow our government is to be ignored. And it's enough to make you want to apply sainthood to agnostics. More important than all that is Trump, the spirit of Dr. King, which was assumed by millions of Americans, is still in evidence. We saw it in the Me Too movement, in the Black Lives Matter movement. And I have to believe in the adage that the only way the forces of evil can succeed is when enough good persons remain silent. I hope America finds its voice. That's our strongest weapon. It's only a start, but with our collective voices comes hope. And I have to be hopeful because I'm not. There's nothing. Here's Betty Carter.
This isn't sometimes, this is always. This isn't maybe, this is always. Yes, it's love, the real beginning. This isn't just midsummer madness, a passing glow, a moment's gladness. This is love, anew it all.
Carter, guess who wrote that song? Betty Carter's a slow take, or it's not somebody that, she's not a singer who jumps out at you when you first hear her. But if you pay attention, she slowly gets into she gets into your skin. There's almost the Billie Holiday quality about Betty Carter, I revere Billie Holiday. It was a very sad day in New York for the dance world. Two great performers left us. Chita Rivera at 91. Not that great a surprise, but those of us who, like myself, who first saw her as Anita in West Side Story and then over the years in many musicals, cherished the great, great gift that she gave us. And the lights will dim on Broadway as we remember the extraordinary Chita Rivera. And I haven't seen an obit in the Times, but I've gotten notes that Hinton Battle, a three-time Tony Award winner, who I thought was a stunning dancer. I think he played the Scarecrow in the original Wiz. He was in Sophisticated Ladies, Jelly's Last Jam. I got to know him a little bit. He was a guest on this program because I was so dazzled by his talent. And at 67, I always thought that Hinton Battle would be forever young and lithe. And he passed at 67. And that saddened me greatly. And we were lucky to have him. Those of us who go to the Broadway theater to have such enormous talents in our place for such a long period of time. Arts Corner, this is. I've talked about that's part of the theater. I have a book review. A fascinating aspect of The Custom of Country, one of Edith Wharton's less celebrated novels, is the absence of any international political events, and as a result, it's difficult to determine the years in which all the machinations take place. And perhaps this is intentional on Miss Wharton's part. Her central figure, Undine Spragg, Moffat, Maxwell, De Chelles, Maxwell, is so insistently self-absorbed that neither war nor economic depression would affect her as she'd only see them as irritants. Undine is consistently the center of social gossip. Arriving in New York City from a lazy Midwestern hamlet, her breathtaking beauty and evidence, along with her determination to be the belle of all balls. She's hungry for wealth and position, and her many marriages evoke scandal, but all were a path to her goals. Edith Wharton, of course, is the brilliant chronicler of the mores of the New York City, of the Manhattan elite, all clustered in the early 20th century. And Undine is one of Miss Wharton's most unappealing characters, yet she is a compelling figure worthy of the author's dissection. May I add that it's a particular pleasure to read a book so meticulously detailed and written with a style, sadly of the past, but no less enjoyable to be absorbed. I was going away, as you know, I wasn't here last week, and I wanted to read something. And I've been reading a lot of books that weren't terribly good. And I said, what did Edie write that I haven't read? Because I had read Ethan Frome and The House of Mirth and The Age of Innocence, and I always appreciated her style, her skill. And so I picked up The Custom of Country and was delighted. And the Oscars came out since I last talked to you. I haven't seen all the tough thing for me is Best Actor. I, from the beginning, said Coleman Domingo was Bayard Rustin, but two other performances have been outstanding, Paul Giamatti in The Holdovers and Jeffrey Wright in American Fiction. The other two, Bradley Cooper in Maestro, he's not going to get it. Gillian Murphy in, as Oppenheimer, won the Golden Globe, but it's a solid performance. But Coleman Domingo as Bayard Rustin is just outstanding. Best Actress, I've seen four of them. One that I haven't seen is Emma Stone in Poor Things. She won the Golden Globe. Of the ones that I have seen, Carey Mulligan as Felicia Montalegro, Mrs. Leonard Bernstein, would be my choice. Best Picture, Oppenheimer's going to win. It has that aura of Oscar winner about it. Past Lives was the movie I liked best. Not going to win. Best Supporting Actor, I don't know. I can't even. It's Robert Downey will probably win for Oppenheimer. I like Sterling Brown in American Fiction. Best Supporting Actress. Davina Joy Randolph won the Golden Globe for The Holdovers, and she might win for the Oscars. If you haven't seen The Holdovers with Paul Giamatti, it's really a good movie. I'm so glad that the documentaries included, one of the nominees was 20 Days in Mariupol, which is one of the best pictures I've seen all year, and that I would vote for best documentary. So that's my arts corner. We have tickets for a couple of other shows. You know, there is something beside the five playing Theater for the New City, where there's always an adventure going on in one of their three theaters. There's a new musical called The Boy Who Listened to Paintings. And we have tickets this week, Thursday, Friday, Saturday night, and Sunday matinee, $40 for a pair of tickets. The Boy Who Learned to Paintings is a musical theater based on the memoir of by the late visual artist and poet Dean Costos, who died in 2022. An award-winning poet. This is the musical story of a young, sensitive visual artist growing up in the 60s in a highly dysfunctional family, bullied to the point of suicide. He contends with his budding sexuality, a flirtation with drugs, and other confusing edges sees in life. And he's saved by the discovering that he is a gift as a poet and as an artist. And the musical is called The Boy Who Listened to Paintings. It's at Theater for the New City, $40 for two tickets this coming Thursday, Friday, or Saturday at 8, next Sunday at 3. You email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. And also this week, we had a lot of tickets for it, and we still have a couple of pair left for Drink with Dead Poets, the Phoenix Company at the Art Theater. It's a play. The conceit of the author is that he has met with some of the great writers of his time, including Sylvia Plath and Emily Dickinson and Langston Hughes, and many other writers and poets. And they have gathered with him on stage, and their words are part of Drinks with Great Dead Poets. It's at the Arc Theater on West 53rd Street. We have tickets for Tuesday and Wednesday night at 7 this week if you make a gift of $50 to BAI. So you email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com and give your phone number. And I'll call you today and you will have an opportunity to see either The Boy Who Listened to Paintings or Drink with Dead Poets. All right, we also play music beside my jabbering away, and we're going to lead into our guest who's written a book. Michelle Horton's book is a stunner. Let's hear from Barbara Cook and Robert Preston. This is from The Music Man, one of the beautiful ballads that Meredith Willson wrote. I had great trouble when I saw The Music Man originally because it defeated West Side Story as best musical. And it took me years to appreciate the great talent that Meredith Willson and what Bob Preston and Barbara Cook brought to that show. it was an irony that I think it was West Side Story that defeated. It's like 1776 beat out Hair, and we were all unhappy about that, which doesn't make the victor any the less capable. Anyway, Sean, maybe we can call our guest, Michelle Horton, while Barbara Cook and Robert Preston are serenading us. Thank you.
There were bells on the hill, but I never heard them ringing. No, I never heard them at all till there was you. There were birds in the sky, but I never saw them winging.
That beautiful ballad by Meredith Willson was in the prize-winning musical The Music Man, and that was the original cast members, Robert Preston and Barbara Cook, singing. We're joined on the phone by Michelle Horton. Good morning, Michelle.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. You're upstate New York. What town are you in?
I'm near Poughkeepsie. I'm in Dutchess County.
I read your book, Dear Sister. It's called A Memoir of Secret Survival and Unbelievable Bonds. The book just has been released, has just been published by Grand Central. I read The Galleys months ago, haven't even looked at it since because it's still simmering in me. It's a story of an incredible, your journey and your sister's journey. Maybe you could begin by just telling us about the case, and then I'll jump in with questions about all the things that came to mind to me while I was reading your journey and your sister Nikki's case, if I may call it that.
Yeah, of course. I mean, her case was public, as small town murder trials are, but in her case, she was in a severely abusive relationship that myself and our family and her closest friends were blind to. And it escalated over the years, as domestic violence does, to homicidal levels. There were teams of people conferencing about her case, you know, documenting that she's a victim, police, district attorneys, therapists. There was photographic evidence. There, you know, were police that wanted to arrest him. And then CPS got called because her bruises became so visible that the community was concerned. And someone called CPS. It ignited a homicidal reaction, as that's what happens with abusers when they lose control. And luckily, my sister got the gun and in instinct of survival pulled the trigger. And she told police all of this. They didn't believe her. They spun a different narrative, and she ended up getting convicted and sentenced to 19 years to life in prison.
When I read the book, Michelle, the thing that jumped out at me, when we read in the paper about a crime, there is the victim and the perpetrator. And what you have done so skillfully is all the other people that are affected that aren't in the headlines, the relatives of the victim, the relatives and friends of the person accused, and the children of all the people. It's a nonstop stream of movement that happens. So I'm interested in what happened when your sister is accused, convicted, and goes away. She has two children, and you had your own son. Tell us about that, you know, the handling of the children and how all this affected them and your family as well.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you got that from the book, because that was a huge reason for why I wanted to write it, because there are all of these experiences that are not reflected in the news or in true crime shows that, you know, entire communities are impacted, especially the children. You know, our women's prisons are filled with mothers and there are children at home, and their experiences aren't told. They're not considered. And I really wanted to show the raw pain that happens when a mother is ripped away, especially if it's unjustly. But for any reason, it's painful when families are separated. And her children were 2 and 4. They had never spent a night away from her. So it was, I mean, challenging to say the least, to soothe them and to explain things to them in age-appropriate ways, and to just go through this journey with them where they're staying connected to this person they love deeply, but she's in a correctional facility.
How did they move in with you? Did they not?
Yeah, I immediately got emergency custody. I thought it was temporary. We all thought it was temporary. And then it turned into permanent custody over time.
And can you assess, we're talking, I guess the case began about 5 years ago.
2017, yeah.
Was it 17? So that's 7 years ago.
Yeah.
But I do want to add this. When I called you to confirm that you're talking, I said, how is Nikki, your sister? And you said, she's sitting with me. So did the case get a reversal?
Yeah. So she was sentenced in 2020. In 2021, her appeal was seen, which we were told less than 1% of cases get reversed on appeal. So there was a very slim chance. But she had a tremendous advocacy network around her. We were being really loud. We had an incredible appellate team. And there was strong evidence that her constitutional rights were violated during trial. One of those is that there was a new law in New York called the Domestic Violence Survivors Justice Act, brand new when she was convicted. And she was set to be one of the first ones to be considered. And this law basically gives a lower sentencing structure for judges when someone who was a victim of abuse commits a crime that's connected to their abuse, like killing
their
abuser.
Was that law passed after her conviction and she got the benefit of it retroactively, or did you not know about the law when?
We knew that the law was going to be signed, like, as her trial was going on.
Wow.
And it was a big deal. And then, truly within weeks of her conviction, it was signed into law. So we then, her attorneys requested a hearing to see if she was eligible for this law. And the judge said, no, she's not eligible. We had a whole, it's in the book. We had a whole hearing where more evidence was seen. And the judge said, you know what? I don't think she's a victim, which was devastating, not just for our family and Nikki, but for all of the other survivors in New York that want to be sentenced under this. And for the advocates that spent 10 years fighting for this law, basically rendered it useless. So then when it went to the higher court, the appellate division, they said, no, her testimony and her evidence shows clearly she was a victim abused by the person she killed, and she should be sentenced under this. And instead of 19 years to life, they resentenced her themselves to 7.5 years. So that
she's on parole now.
She's on parole. She was supposed to be released in July, and she got 6 months off and just surprised everyone and came home in January.
And how have the kids survived? They're living with you, so you know. How have they dealt with all this? And did you bring them to visit? She was at Bedford?
Yeah, she was at Bedford. First, she was at Dutchess County Jail, which is not suitable for children to visit. It's not designed to be a warm and
it's not designed
atmosphere.
For people. I
know. No, it's not designed for people in general. So even visiting is traumatizing. But they were lucky to have private therapy sessions in jail. I mean, very lucky. This is, doesn't happen very often.
The kids
and a play therapist went in and had a private session with Mickey in jail every week. And a lot of that I detail in the book because there's just a lot revealed in those therapy sessions. And then when she moved to prison, there's an incredible organization called Our Children in New York, and they have a parenting center with like toys and stuff. So we were able to have more connection in Bedford, and I brought them every week to see her.
So how are her children?
Everyone is so happy now. I mean, truly, like, you know, kids adapt and we create a new normal, and we had so much therapeutic support around us that the kids weren't, you know, they could have been a lot worse if they were in the foster system, separated, not able to see their mom. In a terrible situation, it kind of was the best case that I was able to continue to foster that connection between them. Again, that's very rare for incarcerated mothers. But now that she's home, it's just like this sense of peace. And it's been less than a month, so we're still all acclimating, but we're living together. They get to cuddle with her every night. It's been wonderful.
There's another component of the book. Your son Noah, I don't know how old, I can't remember, about 7 or 8 when the other kids moved in, and you at some point talk about your deep involvement with the case, and you were fearful of what the impact on your boy would be with the other children getting so much attention and with you being so involved. Has this had an impact on him?
Yeah, it has had a profound impact on him. All the kids have been impacted uniquely, but, you know, the other children, their trauma and pain were so public that so much support and love went to them. And my son, Noah, he was 8 at the time. He's 15 now. He definitely felt forgotten. He felt like he lost me in a lot of respects because I was pulled in so many different directions, and I had kept saying it was temporary, and it didn't end up being temporary. So, he loves his cousins. He's so happy to have his aunt back. He's an incredible kid, but, it definitely impacted him over the years.
And how has it impacted you? This is your first book. Were you a book writer? Was writing the book therapeutic for you? I shouldn't ask questions like that. How has this affected you? And I'm being pejorative when I ask a question like this. How about Michelle? What did you go through?
The grief was just multi-layered, and I think I lived on adrenaline for way too long. But I also had my eyes open to issues that I may never have recognized otherwise, and I really discovered an inner advocate in me that I'm grateful for and developed an incredible community around me that I still rely on to this day. And all of the pain and the grief I'm still obviously coping with. But the book, I was a writer before, and everyone, even as this was going on, kind of joked with me, like, you know, you have to write about this. And I didn't want to, because this is not the book I wanted to write. But Yeah, it's therapeutic to have it done. The reading of the audiobook was very therapeutic, surprisingly. The writing of it was very hard and at times re-traumatizing, and I needed a lot of therapy to get through it. But having done it and processed it through writing, it is the most healing thing I've done to date.
Now that Nikki's home, I want to pass on some sage counsel, if I will. I've been long involved with a program called the Fortune Society, and our CEO, Stanley Richards, who came out of prison in 1991, after doing considerable time, recently said at a meeting, reentry never ends. There's always something that pops up that pulls you back, and you have to be alerted to it. And that's something that people around him have to be aware of. And he's a man out 30 years, so I hope Nikki's listening. Because it's something for her and for you and for people coming out that the trauma of incarceration is so great. And even with a support system and with the crime, there's always something that you have to be aware of that you face. It's called life.
I'm really glad you brought that up.
Pardon me?
I'm glad that you brought that up.
Yeah, that's heavy.
It's like a happy ending. Yeah.
Yeah. Months ago, after I read the book, I called my friend Barbara Allen, who has started years and years ago when her husband went to prison, began a group called Prison Families Anonymous. And I alerted her about the book and about your story because what you're going through is so traumatic and then painfully not unique. There are families that are unprepared for entrance into the criminal justice system all over the country, and they're overwhelmed by the rules and by the system and sometimes the irrelevancy. And Nikki was blessed to have you, and your ability. You said your inner advocate came out. That's in the book. I marveled at your ability to marshal support for the sister that you loved.
Thank you.
I also, you're in a town where the man who was shot by Nikki, his family is in town. That also, and they were at court, and you knew them all before. It wasn't a stranger-to-stranger crime. How does that get affected in a small community? I don't know how big your town is, but it's not Manhattan, so you run into people.
Right. Oh yeah. I mean, I didn't know how small this town was until this happened because everyone's connected and everyone had an opinion. And yeah, it was to say it was hard is like an understatement. It was, and all of us on Nikki's side when we'd go to court, we always reminded people that these are people who lost someone and they're grieving. And they're angry and they're sad, and we need to have compassion for them as well. And we always led with compassion, and I always had a relationship with them for the kids' sake. And I think we've done the best that we possibly can in the situation, but yeah, it's uncomfortable and hard.
And Michelle, you bring that up. The children, Nikki's boy and girl, are the grandchildren of the man who she shot. So is there a relationship, and how do you deal with that?
Yeah, I mean, there is, and we communicate. I've had to have very hard conversations that luckily they've been open to having. We don't see things the same way. We never will, and we've made peace with that. But we understand the other person, the other side, and we love the kids so much that is what we focus on. I see them a couple times a month, and even with the book coming out, like, we still maintain a relationship.
This story is not over. It'll never be over because the children grow up and you're in a town. What have you come away with about the criminal justice system that you, like most people, I suspect you didn't think much about it because it didn't touch your life? Suddenly you're in the middle of this maelstrom. What have you learned, and what do you think? Do you have recommendations?
Oof. I mean, I've learned that this
That's an essay question.
I could talk for a long time, so I'll make it succinct. I've learned that the system is designed to punish first and foremost. It is not designed for victims, and it operates as it uses the tactics that abusers use to maintain power and control over someone, whether it's, you know, trying to control a person in your home or trying to control a defendant or trying to control a prison population. They use the exact same tactics, and it's startling. And until there's some accountability for that, I really don't know how we can continue to tell victims that the system will keep them safe when the system then becomes the next abuser in their life.
When you visited your sister at Bedford Hills, I would assume that there was always a waiting time. I would assume you interacted with a lot of relatives. I know visiting a woman's prison, it's almost all women visiting. I don't know where the fathers, brothers, and cousins are. It's mostly grandma, mothers, sisters, and aunts. What did you learn about how people were navigating that large, lost population of relatives visiting someone they love in prison?
Yeah, I mean, you end up bonding with people because you're waiting sometimes for hours. The rules constantly change. Things are dependent on the guard's mood for the day. So you kind of bond with each other over the ridiculousness of the situation that you're in. And, what always stuck out to me is the humanity and the love that people have when they're going to visit these people that, you know, are important to them. And sometimes they're strangers who just come to visit people. Like, there's an organization called Survived and Punished, and they have advocates who go and they visit these criminalized survivors because they don't have anyone. And sometimes it's the only time they eat is on these visits.
Oh,
so there's just a wide range of people who go to visit children, you know, bonding with other children and seeing them make the best out of a really bad situation. People who travel hours just to get there and then get turned away. It's such an unfair system, and we're all just trying to love the people who are incarcerated the best that we can.
That is an army of ignored people, the relatives of or the friends of somebody who's incarcerated. That's why I've always been impressed by Prison Families Anonymous. I'm going to put them in touch with you if I can, because they have Zoom meetings where they I was a guest on one of them. I was talking to a woman in Nevada and Alaska. It was fascinating that and you know what? When you talk to somebody, as I did, a woman who's father was coming out in New Mexico, it sounded like everything I've heard in New York. The problems are national. And they start with the heart of people like you, that your heart's crushed when somebody you love is incarcerated. Can you talk a little bit before this? I'll let you go on this question. This isn't an essay question. What is Nikki doing now? How is she faring? Not only with the relationship with the children, but she's in the town where the crime took place. So she's a noted woman wherever she goes. How's she dealing with all that?
You know, I hate speaking for her because I know it's so complicated. I mean, it's just, like you said, reentry never ends, and it's so complex, and I'm sure she has different emotions. But I can speak for myself. I've been pleasantly surprised at how welcoming people have been. It's definitely awkward when we're out. Like, we went to Target for the first time 2 days ago, which was exciting, but we went very early when no one would be there. And somebody was like smiling at us a little too long and like waving. And pretty much everywhere we go, somebody you can tell recognizes her, but people have been respectful. And if they say anything, they say like, welcome home, which has been really nice. So I was very scared of what it would look like for her to come back into a community where people, one, feel like they know her, or they, you know, don't like her and they want her to be in prison. But so far, it's been really welcoming.
Is she working? Does she want to work? Can she?
she is going to be, and she has a lot of options she's sifting through. And I know what she was part of a program called Puppies Behind Bars. So she is a certified dog trainer, and raising service dogs is well within her skill set. And that's something she's talking to people about.
Wonderful program. Victims. Wonderful program.
So wonderful.
Dear sister, I know it's just come out. It's a remarkable book. Is there going to be a movie of it, or is it too early to tell?
I guess we'll have to see. I don't know.
has anyone approached you?
In true transparency, we were approached by a production company in combination with the Believe Her podcast, which was done by Justine Vanderloon. It's a phenomenal podcast. If people want to learn more about the case, Justine did a really good job. So the two of our, intellectual properties are being talked about being used in a film.
Well, I've already cast it, but I won't tell you.
I'm interested.
I have to work it through. I don't know if Sandra Bullock is too old to play you. I don't know at this point in her life, but it is a combination of vulnerability and discovered aggression.
I love that idea.
And Nikki, much more frail. Dear sister, I'm gonna let you go out to the two. I didn't plan it, but it's coming up this way. Probably one of the most beautiful songs ever written, sung by one of the best singers ever. And it's a very appropriate song to thank you. It's Nat Cole singing Embraceable You. And when that's finished, I'm going to tell people how they can get the book. Nicole Horton, the book is Dear Sister. Thank you so very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Everybody, there's Nat Cole. Stay tuned. I'll tell you how you can get the book, Embraceable You by George and Ira Gershwin.
Embrace me, my sweet embraceable you. Embrace me, you irreplaceable you. Just one look at you, my heart grows tipsy in me. You and bring up the gypsy in me. I love all the many charms about you. Above all, I want my arms. Come to Papa, come to Papa, do my sweet embraceable you. Thank you.
to Papa, come to Papa, do. My sweet embraceable.
That was recorded in 1961, the Nat Cole Trio, with Nat on the piano. Just stunning. Mm. Dear Sister is a stunning book and an important book. And I read it, I read The Galleys months ago, and it just came to, you know, I couldn't let it go. We have 7 copies of the book, which we're offering. If you make a $50 gift to WBAI, the first 7 people that email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com, which leads me into another topic or a similar topic. Under ordinary circumstances, I would have thought we would have gotten and may still get lots of requests for the book, and I would have pre-ordered, but I can't do that anymore. Because of the Flesh and Spirit story, the Felipe's book. I 2 weeks ago, I got copies of many, many, many emails that listeners, you all, sent to management. I suspect none of you have heard back because I haven't. No one's contacted me. The money that I put out for Flesh and Spirit has still not been repaid, and I have at least a dozen people waiting for copies of it. My suggestion, if you want to read Felipe's book, go to Amazon and get it or check your local bookstore. It was an enormous bonanza for fundraiser for WBAI. We made $10,000 in 2 weeks selling 150 books, and we could have done a lot more, but circumstances prevented it. The same with Dear Sister. We have 7 copies. I suspect there are more than 7 people who would be interested in this beautiful book, supporting us at the same time. It's called Dear Sister, A Memoir of Secrets, Survivals, and Unbreakable Bonds by Michelle Horton. So I am. I await your email, dprfortune@hotmail.com. Emails for 5 keep coming in. We do have other shows. There are other things playing. Drink with Dead Poets. That's this week. If you don't go this week, that's it. Tuesday and Wednesday night. It's at the Art Theater. And the new musical at Theater for the New City, The Boy Who Listened to Paintings. We have tickets for that Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday matinee. And that's $40 for two tickets. So support us and go to the theater. And listen to the wonderful music that we have to play. Well, I do want to say this before we introduce our next singer. I live in the West Village, and we've been tied up and will be for another year or two. At 14th Street and 7th Avenue and 14th Street and 6th Avenue, going down to 13th and up to 15th, because they're building, I don't know if it's escalators or elevators. Wonderful. It's taking forever. The MTA is spending a fortune, a lot of time, and making a lot of noise, making it easier. While they're doing that, can I make a suggestion? The ones that are already in place. I went to Times Square last week, 2 weeks ago, before I went away, at 42nd and 7th. The escalator was not working. Many of us of a certain age, hoping that we would escalate up, had to schlep up those high steps. 2 days later, I took the F train to West 4th Street, which is that's 4 stories below. The escalators not working. So, and walking up 4 flights of stairs ain't easy when you're older than water. And it's not easy when you're younger than water. The point is, while MTA should be congratulated for the industrious nature of their building new facilities for people in the West Village area, take a look at the ones that aren't working. And while I'm at it, at the Angelica Movie Theater, I can't tell you the last time I've been there when the escalator was working. Pay your bill. Get somebody in. Fix it. You know, you make choices about where you go to the theater based on number of steps at the subway stop and whether you can manage the steps at the theater. So, with all of that said, Rosemary Clooney's on deck with a Duke Ellington song, and I'm ready to hear it.
Never treats me sweet and gentle. Not made of wood. I got it bad, and that ain't good. But when the weekend's over and
Rosemary Clooney, the great late Rosemary Clooney. A lot of people emailing for a copy of the book. The first seven will get it. It's called Dear Sister. I was told that I didn't say the title enough. Dear Sister, Dear Sister, Dear Sister. I'm also getting a lot of emails from people who can't hear the program on the internet. This is a continuing epidemic with us. And then lots of other people write email immediately and say, I'm listening on the internet. I don't know what to say. I've reported it to BAI, and of course, I've had no response. So I thunder in an empty forest. I was talking basketball at the beginning about the Knicks and the fact that they have taken the town's heart again. But I want to make another comment. There's a player for Philadelphia. He was the most valuable player last year named Joel Embiid. I was not a big fan of his at the beginning. He seemed a little cranky, but a sterling basketball player. But as I've gotten to know him, I don't know him personally. He's from Cameroon, and I've been reading about the amount of work that he's been doing for people in his own country, which is West Africa. And it's rather impressive. And then in some of the interviews and post-game things, I find that this big guy is – got a heart and a personality that's endearing. He also has been injured and is having a knee problem and was out for a couple of games. And I watched the other night when he was playing against the Warriors, and I immediately said, that's not Joel Embiid. He's walking too slowly. He shouldn't be playing. And they were praising about that old thing about that it takes a lot of guts to play while hurt. Well, it also means that you could endanger your life's career. And watching the Warriors game, I kept saying, take him out, take him out. And then there was a collision and he fell and one of the opponents landed on his bad leg and he was hobbling out. And now there's word that he's having an MRI. There's this whole notion about that you're more of a man if you play hurt. And considering the number of former, particularly pro football players, who have dementia at an early age, that definition of manhood should not just be about playing while hurt. It also should be about having the sense to survive and to protect your body. That winning the game is important because that's what you do, but it's not everything. And that I hope Joel Embiid, who's still a young guy, mid-20s, that he has a long career, but could be in danger. And one of the things that came about, that if you miss, there's a new rule that if you miss, I think, 15 or 18 games, you're ineligible for the Most Valuable Player Award. And there was a feeling that he might be playing games he shouldn't to get in under the wire to be eligible for the MVP award. I'm not just talking about pro athletes. I'm talking about kids playing games. Don't play hurt. If you hurt, take care of the hurt, and you'll play more tomorrow. It's kind of basic, is it not? Who do we have musically for us now? Victor Moon, here's with a return. This was a big song back in the day with a Jimmy Webb song, MacArthur Park.
Spring was never waiting for us, girl. It ran one step ahead as we followed in a dance. Between the parted pages and were pressed in love's hot fevered iron like a striped pair of pants. MacArthur Park is melting in the dark, all the sweet green icing flowing down. Someone left the cake out in the rain, and I don't think that I can take it, cause it took so long to bake it, and I'll never have a recipe again. There will be another song for me. To my hands, and I will use it. I will win the worship in their eyes, and I will lose it. Rivers to the sky. But after all the love
is melting in the dark. All the sweet green icing blowing down. Someone left the cake out in the rain, and I don't think that I can take it. I've been so long to bake it, and I'll never have the recipe again.
Well, you've just been to Las Vegas. That's a Las Vegas production number. Vic Damone, who sang a lot in Las Vegas, and was a very, he was very, in the when Sinatra was big, there were many who were compared to him, and Vic Damone favorably so. He also married Diane Carroll along the way, one of those interesting interracial marriages that didn't create much of a stir in Hollywood. So this, I don't know when it was. I wasn't with you last week, so I don't know the exact time, but I made a note of it. I was watching that embarrassing scene when Tim Scott was with Donald Trump at something, and he said, you know, you're not running, or you don't like Nikki Haley. And he said, no, it's not that I don't like her. I love you. Tim Scott reportedly seems to be hanging around with the curious notion that he could become vice president under in a Trump administration. Tim, let me tell you something. It ain't going to happen. The base, are you not familiar with the racist component of the base? What Make America Great Again means that they want to return to plantation mentality of white privilege threatened by the rise of black men and women. It's a lot of it is a response to the very fact that Barack Obama was president. They would not tolerate a Tim Scott presidency. Steve Bannon has said Trump will probably pick a woman. That means Steve Bannon is suggesting that he pick a woman. And the senator from Tennessee, the governor from South Dakota, God help us, the congresswoman from North and New York, Elisa, whatever her name is, the candidate for Senate in Arizona, was she for Senate or governor, who hasn't conceded Teddy Roosevelt's victory yet. Fascinating. Anyway, Tim, it's quite simple that you're not reading it. You might get a cabinet post, postmaster general, ambassador to Cameroon, but you ain't going to get the vice presidency. You're a black man, and in Trump's America, that doesn't earn a vice presidency. One heartbeat from the president wouldn't be tolerated by his base, and they know it, and that's what they feel anyway. And how could you not know it? You're a senator in the United States Senate. And Romazzi, you just got married or announced your engagement to make it possible for you to have all the credentials in place. And while we're at it, polls are telling us. Now, at this early stage, it doesn't mean much for that. Bobby Kennedy can get 20% of the vote. A lot of young people. That may fade as it goes along, and who knows what may happen with his alleged candidacy. But if he gets 20%, that might throw the election into the House of Representatives. The question is it the current House or the new House? And will the new House be controlled by the Republicans? Or will it be controlled? Will it be enough? with those four House seats, you know, if Tom Suozzi wins in the Santos race this week, the Republican majority is 2. Without Hochul on the top of the slate, will those 4 Republican swing votes in the New York congressional delegation go Democratic? Because that's what swung the House. New York swung the House because Hochul's coattails weren't long enough to pull in four good Democrats running against some marginally. They're not terrible, but it's not a question of whether they're terrible or not terrible as Republicans. It's that their vote gives, their presence gives a majority. And while we're at it, Mike Johnson's having trouble. He's only been in for 5 minutes and they're already carrying on because he's talking about the government being more important and people like Matt Gaetz and Marjorie Taylor Greene are ready to throw him under the bus. And he ain't no prince. So it's all very busy right now. It's if you're following politics, you might not be. Well, if you're not following politics, you don't. A lot of people are not. They don't want to follow until the summer, and it may be too late because don't pay any attention to the polls right now. They don't mean anything. And what happens with Trump on the trials will be a factor. And are enough Americans ignorant, not ignorant, ill-informed about the possibility of a dictatorship and what that would mean in America, which, and I'm not putting words in his mouth, those are his words. Let's go get you some theater tickets. I think we have enough calls here to sell the house out a couple of times. Theater for the New City, a musical, The Boy Who Listened to Paintings, based on the life of the late visual artist and poet Dean Costas, who died in 2022, is the story of a young, sensitive visual artist growing up in the 60s in a highly dysfunctional family, considered suicide, having trouble with his sexuality, a flirtation with drugs, and he was saved by his discovery of his gift as a writer and as a poet. And this is a new musical, The Poet Who Listened to Paintings. It's at the Theater for the New City. And, you know, we've had a few shows there in the last few weeks, and people have been raving about them. And a lot of people don't respond because I don't know why. I shouldn't put it into people's – I shouldn't interpret why somebody doesn't call on something. Is it because it's on First Avenue and 9th Street? I don't know, as they say in England. Anyway, the Theater for the New City is on First Avenue and 9th Street. And The Boy Who Listened to Paintings, we have Thursday, Friday, and Saturday night and Sunday matinee. $40 for two tickets. What? I mean, that's, do I have to sell it to you? And Drink with Dead Poets, Tuesday and Wednesday night this week at 7 o'clock at the Art Theater, the Phoenix Company, doing a play in which the playwright has... The playwright is Oliver Nonning, and he has created a play in which he resurrects iconic American authors, including Robert Frost, Allen Ginsberg, Hart Crane, Sylvia Plath, Langston Hughes, Gwendolyn Brooks, Dorothy Parker, Emily Dickinson, and through their words, they interact with this man who is having a journey into the dead poets. Drink with Dead Poets. Fascinating concept. It's at the Art Theater. We have a couple of pair left on Tuesday night, February 6th and Wednesday, February 7th at 7 o'clock, the Art Theater on West 53rd Street. If you email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. And I'll stop babbling in time to hear a encore from Betty Carter with a song by Julie Stein and Sammy Kahn. Betty.
There never was such a moon, such a moment so opportune. The setting makes your charms so saleable, though you're in my. You're unavailable. You say some other time I do as well. My only answer, darling, is who can tell? Someone just you. Yes, some other time, not now. There is no rain now that I've kissed you. This heart of mine betrays me.
Great Betty Carter. I can't think of any way better than observing Black History Month than paying attention or going to see our friend Melvin McRae's exhibit, photographs. Photographic essay is called The Long Journey Passage, Black Men, Long Journey Forward, Black Men in Passage. Melvin McRae's photographs of four extraordinary leaders, Nelson Mandela, Julius Nyerere, John Lewis, and Barack Obama. The photographs are at a gallery, the Wilmer Jennings Gallery at 219 East 2nd Street at Avenue B. It's going to be there until March 9th. Let's see. The gallery is open Wednesday to Saturdays from 11 o'clock to 6. The Wilmer Jennings Gallery, 219 East 2nd Street, Wednesday to Saturday, 11 to 6, Long Journey Forward, Black Men in Passage, Melvin McRae's collection of pictures of four important men who affected the lives of millions. Let's go out with a little bit of Nat Cole and Moon Indigo. And I'm with you on Monday at 9. Sometimes they replay this show tomorrow. I don't know what they, you know, that's up to BAI. Thank you for rejoining me today. It was nice to have been away. It's better to be back. Here's Nat Cole with a Duke Ellington beautiful song.
That feeling. go stealing down to my shoes while I sit inside. Go long blue, always get that mood indigo since my baby said.
Good morning. You're tuned to 99.5 FM WBAI in New York. Any Saturday with David Rothenberg came to you live over listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York. Coming up at 10 o'clock is On the Count. Please stay tuned.
This is Mike Sargent. This Day in Racial Injustice. On this day, February 3rd, in 1948, a black woman, Rosa Lee Ingram, and her children, Wallace, 17, and Sammy Lee, 14 years old, were sentenced to death for defending themselves. The three were convicted by an all-white jury in a one-day trial in Ellaville, Georgia. The family members were sentenced to death by electric chair for killing an armed white man in self-defense after he violently assaulted and threatened them. The attack occurred on November 4, 1947, when John Stratford, a white landowner armed with a shotgun and a pocket knife, attacked Miss Ingram, a widow who worked as a sharecropper on his farm near Ellaville, Georgia. Testimony later revealed that Stratford hit Ingram in the head with the butt of his rifle while threatening to sexually assault her and shoot her. Rosalie Ingram's sons rushed to their mother's aid when they heard her screaming as she was being attacked. One son struck Stratford with a farm tool, killing him. Ingram and her sons were arrested soon after Stratford was found dead. Even though the local sheriff admitted that the sons acted in defense of their mother, all three were sentenced to death by electrocution, and their execution was scheduled for February 27th. Though Wallace and Sammy Lee Ingram were both minors, they were eligible for execution under the law at the time. The U.S. Supreme Court didn't ban the execution of children until 2005. After a post-trial motion and a pressure from civil rights activists, the trial judge changed the Ingram sentences to life imprisonment. Then, in July 1948, the Georgia Supreme Court affirmed their convictions and life sentences. Though Rosalie Ingram and her sons no longer had death sentences, they were sent to the state penitentiary and were each forced to serve more than a decade in prison for daring to defend themselves against a violent armed assault by a white man. They were not released on parole till 1959. This has been This Day, February 3rd, in Racial Justice from the Equal Justice Initiative, and this is listener-sponsored WBAI.
David Kenny of Everything Old is New Again, every Sunday night at 10. Please join me then, and please support WBAI at our brand new old number, which is 212-209-2950. Again, that's 212-209-2950.